Thank you for downloading an OnSale Radio podcast. Epic Night continues at OnSale Radio. We keep it going with Editor-in-Chief of the Epic Poker League and returning champion to the Ryan Slayer Show, having survived Jimmy Lee, Mr. Michael Craig. Sitting down with Michael was an excellent way to kill an hour, and he is now on my list of favorite storytellers. We talked about it if you thought about it, I think, so pack a lunch and have a listen. More about Michael and Epic after the interview. Enjoy. Listen, I promise you, Jimmy Lee won't be stopping by tonight, so it'll be just you and me.
Okay, that's fine. Nice guy, though.
Yes, Jimmy something. So we had Annie on earlier, and you're, of course, affiliated with Epic Poker League, too. Now, I didn't get to talk to you the last time when you were on my show, and I apologize. So for those that don't know and are new people, what's your function with Epic? How'd you get involved with them?
I'm the editor-in-chief of EpicPoker.com, the website. And so that involves the coverage of Epic Poker's events, as well as the website, as we try to make it into a be-all and end-all place for people who want to learn about the best poker players in the world. I got involved because Annie asked me last year after I left writing the blog for Full Tilt. I guess my timing was fortuitously good, but she had asked me if I was interested in doing some work on a project she was in, and it turned out to be the Epic Poker League, and so I advised from early on about some ideas for the website and then became involved in putting together content as well as encouraging other people to put together content for the site.
Yeah, I've noticed you've got a lot of contributors to the blogging section of the website. What kind of stuff do they write about normally?
What we do is we're trying to put together regular columns so that people get to take advantage of the predictability of having so many good people writing. On Monday, Jessica Wellman, who is the managing editor of Bluff, writes Epic Adventures, which talks about Epic players in the spotlight during the past week. So, for example, she wrote about Sam Trickett's win at the Partouche Poker Tour over the weekend, and they finished their main event. Also, on Monday, we'll run a feature called Know the Pro, where every week we'll pick a league member and provide a profile of them with some information about the player you might not otherwise know. This week it was about Eric Baldwin, interesting fellow who's a great poker player, won a World Series of Poker bracelet, and also an NCAA baseball championship back in 2005. Tuesday, we have a community chest about poker and mass media. We also have winners and losers about the winners and losers in poker news over the previous week. Wednesday, we have the law blog about legal developments. We also have a player to watch, which will be about a player who's not part of the league, about what they're doing lately and how they're developing as a poker star. We also have columns about advice, a John Vorhaus column called Fish Bites Man for beginning poker players. And also Social Director, which is about social media and poker. So, for example, after the main event final table, that column was devoted to some of the big issues about the final table and what people were tweeting during the final table.
You know, it's one of the bigger or more in-depth blog sections that I've seen for most website of, you know, this type, or for a poker league or something like that. It must help a lot to have that discussion always happening where there's always new discussion going on and topical content where at the tables it must spill over a little bit and people are, you know, it must help with the energy, the overall feel of the game.
Yes, I believe so. Again, part of our mission, obviously, is to report on Epic Poker. So, for example, when Epic events are on television, like the second main event is on Velocity this Friday and on CBS on Saturday for the final table of our second event. We're obviously putting together an event companion so that people who watch the TV show, when they come to the site, they'll find things they like, and people who are on the site will learn about the TV final table and reasons why they should be watching that. So part of our job is trying to keep people up on Epic Poker, but also because Epic Poker is a player's first league, and the idea is, you know, to share and celebrate the lives and games of the best players in the world, we also want to be a good destination. So in addition to having like a really healthy roster of blog contributors, we're also turning these people's direction to big events that are coming up. So for example, when the WSOP had its November 9, even though we weren't quote-unquote covering the event, I mean, it was ably covered by ESPN when they showed the delayed live coverage, we had our social media column devoted to it, our winners and losers column, and so even though it's not our event and we're not directly involved in it, because it is important to poker, the World Series of Poker Final Table, we've harnessed all these great, all these great writing minds together. Now you have an opportunity to read their take on these things.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit. The WSOP. What did you think of the way it's covered, with the little 15-minute delay and the people that were actually covering the games? How did you like it?
I enjoyed watching it. I would hardly call myself representative, because I've watched the final table in person every year since 2005 and seen a lot of bizarre things, and the strangest stuff happens in the middle of the night usually. And so I feel like I could write an entire book about bizarre things that have happened at the final table of the World Series. So for me, an opportunity to not have to leave my home office and get to watch every hand is wonderful. I don't know if that's, if that's sufficiently casual viewer friendly enough to catch on. I don't know how their ratings compared with when they do the final table as a 1 hour or 2 hour special. I have to say, I liked their coverage quite a bit. I thought Antonio Estendiari was fabulous. I mean, I think he's a great guy, and he's funny and interesting, but I think he went beyond the call of duty. Pardon?
He was spot on a lot, too. He was calling hands and what people had and bets and cards, and he was dead on a lot. I was really surprised at how spot on he was.
Yeah, I agree. I thought it was very impressive. But one of the things that it shows me, and it reveals to everybody, and I hope everybody with a large audience, constitutes a large audience, is that this is, I mean, Espendiari is one of the top players in the world, but it's not like he's three times better than all the other great players. The point is that he's very good at expressing himself and very smart, but, Epic Poker League is filled with guys that are this smart, and while they couldn't all be as great commentators as Antonio, the point is that this is how the best players in the world think, that they're, as well as fans of poker think they understand poker, we understand checkers, and these guys understand chess, and it's great that they can communicate these things to us. So I think part of it is a great asset that somebody like Antonio is sharing this knowledge. And also, I look at it, from my EpicPoker.com hat, is this is how smart these guys are. As the editor-in-chief of the Epic Poker site, I need to make it my job so that people understand that, the top players, guys like Antonio or Ben Lamb or Mike McDonald or Eric Seidel, that these guys think this way and evaluate these things this way. And people get an opportunity to understand what's going on in their head, they're going to enjoy poker more.
Or be a lot more afraid of it, I guess. If I sat down across from Antonio now, as opposed to after hearing him on ESPN, I might have been a little intimidated before, but now I would be just straight up scared.
I know, especially because you watch Antonio on TV and you see he'll make some really bizarre plays or he's goofing around at the table. That causes you, I mean, the same thing is true when you see somebody like Mike Mattisau or Phil Hummuth, is that it kind of causes you to underrate their talents a little bit, because they're such great show people, or when you hear them as commentators, they're such great commentators, you forget that these people are really brilliant analytical minds, that this is the same thing as, going to dinner and seeing the guy at the next table, the big athletic looking guy, and then seeing him, he's an NFL wide receiver, and the guy is just doing, incredible physical feats that you can barely see, barely imagine, people being able to do. And that's the way these poker players are. They're incredible mental athletes. And, my job with Epic is to reveal that to people. And Antonio, in his commentary in the World Series, just showed you, this is how these guys think. And while it's incredibly complicated, they can also kind of like open up the door a little bit to you. And you can kind of see that it's not just a matter of these guys, playing to the camera or goofing around or getting lucky, that every single hand, this is what they're doing. This is why it's a game of skill, because this is how they're always thinking.
And it comes from hours upon hours and upon hours of practice. They've played
probably
days of time.
I think it was Malcolm Gladwell who wrote, but he said that, the basic formula behind being the world's best at something is you need to spend 10,000 hours practicing. That if you you know, if you look at somebody like the Beatles and you say, oh my God, you know, those guys got together and they got so lucky and they were in the right place at the right time and they were just so incredibly popular. Gladwell went through and figured out how long these guys spent practicing together from pieces of their, you know, biographies, autobiographies, old interviews and things like that. And they essentially spent about 10,000 hours playing together before they became successful. And that's definitely true in poker, that these guys have put in a lot of time, and that's what makes them so good.
Yeah, you know, it's one thing to know the math of it and just know the formulas behind it, but when you're actually feeling the math in a way where you can tell, as you know, Antonio does and some of the others like Daniel Negreanu, those are really good at reading people. They feel the math more than they actually do it in their head, and like you said, that just comes from experience and all those hours of practice. What do you think?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Right. The math in poker, and I think people, you know, are sometimes intimidated by it when they don't understand it, is mostly math that we've all learned in seventh grade. That, for instance, you know, just being able to figure out something like if you have a straight draw, that means there are eight cards that you need to hit. And if you've got two chances to hit it, the turn and the river, that there's a shortcut where if you multiply by four, that's the percentage of you're hitting it in two cards, or by two, the percentage in one card. So if somebody says, okay, I've got a straight draw, that means I've got about a 1 in 3 chance of hitting it. That's not really the result of super sophisticated math. I mean, Barry Greenstein is a PhD level, you know, another PhD level math student. Chris Ferguson had a PhD in computer science, but it's not because of that type of education. They know instinctively that, you know, with a straight draw, they've got a 1 in 3 chance of hitting. Or when they're looking into implied odds or pot odds or things like that, it's mostly basic functions. But you got to be so good at it that you just kind of do it unconsciously, so that you can spend the time soaking up the atmosphere of the table and getting those kind of vibration-like feelings about whether somebody's strong or weak, and that you strategically don't put yourself in a bad spot. So the actual math involved is not that difficult, but there are a lot of little pieces to it, and being able to do it effortlessly while you're doing other things, like, you know, cracking wise at the table and trying to really, you know, feel out your opponent's strength and weakness, that's where all the skill comes in.
See, kids, stay in school and practice. That's the main message. So what do you think of the layover? I don't personally like it. I understand it's all for money and advertising dollars. What do you think of the stoppage midsummer and then bringing it back up in November? Shouldn't they just start
I always thought it was a good idea. Jeffrey Pollack, when he was running the World Series, was part of the group or the head of the group who was responsible for putting that in, and not just because of his affiliation with Epic Poker. I supported it back then as a good idea because, to me, it was an attempt at something. It was a recognition that poker had gotten past the moneymaker years, and people weren't just going to turn on poker because it was on TV. It had to be something good, and that poker players weren't going to get attention just because poker was interesting. The players needed to be interesting, and at that time gave an opportunity for the media to try to make more out of the players and for the players to try to, you know, cash in somewhat and develop their fame. And so I thought that was a good idea. Watching it now and hearing about all the players who did the coaching and the analysis they've done, and then when you put out on a 15-minute delay, and then they've got spotters that are checking the live broadcast and then transmitting to them what the hands are from, you know, past levels the players have been folding or, you know, have had when they folded, I think that complicates things quite a bit. But I generally like the idea of trying to do things to promote the broadcast and trying to promote poker players, and I think that was what the goal of it was.
Yeah, I guess I could buy trying to, you know, build these people up a little more, but then, you know, at the same time, it also, I think it hurt Phil Collins. I think going in, Phil Collins was the man, he had the momentum, he was on a roll, and I think it just kept going at that point. He might have been the winner or much closer than he got, but who's to say? I mean, if you have all that extra layover, now you can study these people that you wouldn't have had a chance to study before.
Right, no, it's true. The outcome could potentially be different. I thought that Phil had a real strong chance going in, and again, I'm not, you know, it's not for me to be an accurate judge of the quality of his play, but I didn't, you know, he tried doing some things at the final table that I'm sure he spent a lot of time thinking of over the 3.5 months, And maybe it's just the way that they worked out, or my not getting my mind around them, but I think some of them probably weren't as good at the things he was doing when he was playing 7 days straight and, you know, kicking butts and taking names. So, you know, that could be the case. On the other hand, I thought that the quality of play was uniformly high. And so I think that, the people definitely got to see poker players playing at their best as a result of this delay. These guys would probably play a great final table if they just played it the next day.
Yeah, and no, I mean, not to take away from anyone else that won it, or PS, or the other fellas, Dashko. I mean, the final table, the two of them was, it went on for, as a casual fan, it wasn't, as a casual TV fan of poker, it wasn't my thing to watch them just trade chips for a couple hours, which it was
right.
For about 3 hours. It was just back and forth. So, obviously, a tape delay would have helped that with editing, but still, it was a fantastic, battle all the way through, and it was, I think overall, it finished out well, and I think the WPSO, you can be pleased with it. But it's not the only thing on TV. You guys got your own little TV thing going.
Right. Our second main event is on TV. The first 2 hours of coverage have already appeared on Velocity, although I believe they periodically rerun that coverage. The third hour of coverage for event number two, which is the beginning of the final table, is this Friday at 10 p.m., and then the main ending of the final table is Saturday at 1 p.m. on CBS. And I think, and I have to compliment the World Series. I thought they have taken a step forward in doing things like letting check counts and letting the blind levels and the size of stacks. I think that correspondingly, part of our strength is that by having the best players in the world playing, having a structure that gives them a lot of play even at the final table, and then having good statistics and having good information about chip counts and the levels and the size of the stacks gives you a good context, so that it's not always a matter that the hand is dramatic because one guy has queens and the other has tens, and then a 10 comes on the flop, and then a card comes that gives the guy with the queen a chance to make a run or straight. That while that's dramatic, that isn't where the skill in poker is. So an opportunity to see guys, four betting before the flop and putting each other to the test, or guys hitting monster hands and figuring out ways to suck other world-class players in, I think that's where some of the real interest is, as well as the time that, doing 4 hours of coverage on our main event will give to be able to tell the story. So you can learn things like the Dutch Boyd got a law degree when he was 18 years old, or that Mike McDonald, just 22 years old, has already largely retired from being a full-time poker player, or different things about different players. It's just, the broadcast have the freedom to do things like that. And obviously, we're trying to do the same thing on the website.
I was just talking to Dutch the other day. I didn't know he got a law degree at 18.
Yes, he graduated. He graduated from high school. He started college when he was, I believe, he was just short of 13. I think he was still 12 when he started college, and he got his law degree from the University of Missouri when he was 18. Second youngest law school graduate in American history. Please don't ask me who the youngest was, because I don't know the answer to that. It was somebody who was not. I guarantee that it wasn't somebody who's got two World Series bracelets.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Wow, I didn't know that. I'm going to have to ask about that. That's really cool. You're on CBS, which, when someone says CBS, the first thing they would never think on a CBS broadcast is poker. And when we had Annie on last time, I gave her kudos too, because how cool it was to have a network like that that never would normally carry something. It was always had a stigma for being, just straight up and not real edgy or anything like that.
Not part of poker.
Yeah, but, and then
did you tell you a piece of trivia?
No, go ahead. Yeah.
Oh, the first poker broadcast ever was on CBS.
Was it really?
Yeah, oh, I think that she told me this, because she and I, a couple of months ago, were kind of like giggling over this information about how we wanted to make sure we publicize this in a proper way, not to say there's any link between CBS and the World Series coverage as it exists today, or the coverage from 1973 and the way we're covering it now, but that the World Series was, to some degree, an idea from Jimmy the Greek. Jimmy the Greek Snyder, who was the odds maker and publicist and CBS broadcaster during the 70s and 80s, he was responsible, or at least partly responsible, for coming up with the name World Series of Poker. because he thought he recognized there was some publicity in having something called the World Series, that it would clue people in that this was a championship that was taking place. And he was a friend of the Binions, involved in the publicity business in Las Vegas, and was helping them promote it during the first few years, and had gotten CBS to do a documentary style coverage of the 1973 final table that he narrated and appeared in. And I have an ancient bootleg of that, and it's very interesting. Obviously, this is decades before the whole card camera, so there's never any hand where you know what the players have, unless there ends up being a showdown, and then they edit it in later on, and so you can hear like in a different voice one of the players, one of the commentators says, you could have a big pocket pair here. That must mean that they've already seen the showdown, and this is something that they put in later on. But it's really interesting. And an original study with CBS.
That's neat. I had no idea. A little history. Wow, we're learning all kinds of stuff from Michael tonight. So as editor-in-chief.
Oh, by the way, this is the kind of stuff you routinely find on Epic Poker.
That's right. as editor-in-chief of EpicPoker.com, how do you take what's on your website and try to keep someone like a CBS happy? Because one of the reasons I was surprised that CBS itself actually did this was the climate with the way poker is right now, the legal climate stigma it has wasn't lending itself to TV, and advertisers were pulling out. And I thought it took tremendous guts on their part to say, hey, let's do a poker show now. This is the time to actually do one. So how do you make sure what goes on with the website isn't too much for them or too less? I just wonder how that all works.
But what we're trying to do is, on the one hand, I guess what I would say is we're hoping to be everything for everybody. I mean, eventually, I'm sure there are some compromises there, but there are some people that are going to look at our site and say, oh, this is like, elementary stuff, I'm not interested. Or somebody else is going to look at the same stuff and say, whoa, too much, he has three outs and he has 33%. And so we're trying to come up with different approaches to a few different people. Part of what we're doing is we're trying to educate people and encourage them to understand the great strategies involved. But also, to me, I think what's always interested me about poker players, and has really been my mission since I started writing about poker in 2004, is that these are really interesting people who have interesting lives and very unusual jobs. And if more people understood their lives and understood their jobs, they would find poker more interesting. And so part of it is, if you go to our broadcast companion for Main Event 2, you see like this wonderful scrapbook that has highlights from our live coverage of the event, pictures of players, videos from the players. We also have some of the features that appeared. For example, there's a gambling game that poker players play. I don't know if you discussed it on your show. It's called Lob and Thinks. Are you familiar with the game, Lob and Thinks?
Say it again. What is it?
Lob and Thinks.
Gosh, that sounds familiar.
Oh, the game was invented by Phil Rock and Antonio Espendiari and European poker player Johnny Lodden a couple of years ago on TV in Europe. Antonio and Phil wanted to gamble at the table in between hands, because they're gamblers. And what they wanted to do is they wanted to bet on what Lodden thinks, what Johnny Lodden thinks the answers are to different questions. So, for example, one of them would say, okay, Johnny Lodden, how many regular poker players do you think there are in North Korea? Now, Johnny Lodden would think of an answer. Now, again, that's not something you could probably objectively ever find out. But what these guys are betting on is what Lodden thinks. So the first thing they're thinking of is, what does Lodden think the population of North Korea is? And, of course, they're thinking on their own, what's the population of North Korea? But they're thinking, well, what does Johnny Lodden know, and what will he think? And so they come up with their ideas of what he's thinking, and then they do a Chinese-style auction bidding on what his answer will be. Then he reveals the answer, and the winner is the one who comes closest to his answer. Again, it could be that there are 10,000 regular poker players in North Korea, and Johnny Lodden said the answer is 11 people. But they may have figured out, one of them may have said, Lodden's going to say 100, and the other one's going to say, okay, I'll take the over. And then the guy who had the under 100 ends up winning because Johnny Lodden said the number was 12. So, you know, whatever. And so, obviously, Johnny Lodden can't be at every poker table all the time. So, whenever you have a game, you have two bettors who are also the ones who come up with the questions, and then you have somebody play Lodden. And so, at our second event on the first day, the guys at the table, including Antonio, who happened to be there, Greg Mueller, Justin Young, and Jamie Kaplan were at the table, and they got involved in this game, and some of the questions and answers are just bizarre. Like, for instance, and we wrote a feature about this. This is now part of our companion coverage from event number two. So if you go to our event two companion coverage, you can read this article about, you know, somebody posed the question, if Greg Mueller, Antonio Esfandiari, and Justin Young had a year to plan a bank robbery, what's the chance they could get any money out of the safe? And so, you know, the, you know, again, there's no objective answer, but they're, you know, the people who were betting on this were trying to guess what, you know, the person who played Lodden would think such an answer would be. Another question was, how much would you have to pay Justin Young and Greg Mueller to spend an entire year no more than 100 feet apart from each other at all times? And so, you know, again, it doesn't matter what the real amount is, but it's what the person who plays Lodden is thinking. Another question was, what did the person who played Lodden think the total number of sexual partners everybody at the table had? It was eight-handed plus the dealer. So it was, you know, figuring out what the person who played Lodden would think that number was. In fact, the guy who played Lodden ended up picking a number of like 800. And, you know, which to me suggests that he thinks that everybody in poker is having an orgy all the time.
Yeah.
You got several ways of people under 30, and just kind of like, that's really 100 partners per each. Seems kind of odd. You always get that when people play this game. And so, you know, this doesn't tell you about odds or strategy or anything like that, but it's extremely entertaining. And it also keys you in a little bit on what poker players think about and how they, you know, how they regard things as a proposition and a game. And so there's an article that we have about that that's in connection with our coverage. So while somebody who might think our coverage, you know, who might think our coverage has too much about big hands and odds and outs, somebody who doesn't understand all that stuff would enjoy learning about this. On the other hand, we also have key hands from each episode with some description of the hands and either a spoiler alert or no spoiler alert, so you know whether it's going to spoil the conclusion of the hand for you, but you can find out what some of the key hands are going to be or what some of the big issues are that are coming up.
When Annie mentioned, and one of the things about Epic that, you know, you guys try to promote is that it's smaller fields, much better players. And then, like you said, you can build on those players. But at some point, it's going to get bigger, right? And you do want it to get bigger, where it'll be larger fields. How will you maintain that small, you know, homegrown feel with these, with all the players, when it's going to be much bigger than it is?
Well, it's, you know, it's hard to tell what the future will bring. And so, you know, we're kind of taking it as it comes. As it is now, we had for the first event 137 players. For the second event, 97. I think we'll probably have 140 or 150 for our December event. And the,
not if you keep winning them. Do you catch any flack around the Epic offices for winning the game, or no?
Oh, you mean the charity event that we had last time? A little bit, although so many people. I mean, I can't play in the league. I'm about $1 million short of earnings to have qualified, and I really can't play in the pro-am. There may be a conflict of interest, but regardless of the conflict, I'm supposed to be reporting on it and, you know, arranging our coverage. Plus, if I somehow won the pro-am and started playing the event, again, I would be sitting there playing at the time I'm supposed to be working. So I can't play, I can't play the pro-am either, nor can really anybody there. But, you know, the charity event, because it is for charity, the prizes are all donated and all the money goes to charity, I'm allowed to play it. So, you know, spending all this time around poker and not getting to play really bugs me.
Yeah.
So it's a great deal of fun to play. And all the, you know, a lot of the other people who are involved in the events are also playing. And so, it sort of becomes, I mean, obviously for me, it's like it's grabbing rights over Annie, because Annie's a great player, a world famous player. And so, any tournament I can be in where I'd be better than her, is great. And of course, in this tournament, we had a lot of league members because, that's the two plays in the charity, since it's right before our events. This field has 50 players in it, and the field probably had 20 players that had World Series bracelets. So here for a $250 buy-in, I'm playing with players like David Chu and Phil Hellmuth and Eric Seidel and Annie Duke. And so it was, you know, it's just a great deal of fun. We put everybody in a good mood and having a nice time. You're raising money for charity. And then all of a sudden I'm at the final table and I'm heads up against Phil Hellmuth. And Hellmuth has got his game face on. Maybe he's just being nice to me and, you know, acting like he was taking it seriously. But at one point at the final table, I had raised and he threw away face up pocket clean. So I felt like, you know, Hellmuth was really trying here. So for me to be able to beat a, you know, world famous player like that, again, not when there's hundreds of thousands on the line, but when, you know, his pride is on the line and he's, you know, he's a competitor trying to win, it's a great highlight for me. So it's just wonderful fun.
That's, I would get a T-shirt made if I were you that says, I beat Phil Hellmuth, and then you know, on the back you can put the list of the other bracelet winners that you need to. Yeah, get that made up for him, will you? So we were talking, how are you going to maintain this this, you know, this homegrown feel and this really close.
Oh, when it gets bigger, we'll figure out a way. I don't think the league is going to get hugely, hugely bigger, at least in the near term, because, I mean, we have 253 members this year. Players have to play at least one of the four events to maintain their membership for next year. So players that haven't been involved, they won't be members next year. So the membership will drop. Obviously, new players will become members, because they'll meet the qualifications, and so some players will drop out, some players will be added on, and so I think that it's still going to be fairly select fields, and so and whatever the size of the fields are, I mean, even if we add all 253 players play, the point is whatever the size of the field is, it's all people that have won, you know, major titles or seven figures or cashed, you know, multiple times and, you know, made lots of final tables. So it's always going to be a little bit of, a home field because these guys, although they're competitors, they're also friendly with each other. And so, you know, you're seeing people who are really respectful of each other, going at it like gladiators, and it's a great combination. And even if we have twice as many people, and I think it'll still have that feeling.
Well, I hope it does. It's you guys have taken right off, and I think it's great. We love it. We love it here. So, and we can't say no to Annie. So, whatever Annie says is fine with me. I'm sure.
I work for her, so I know better than anybody. it's a great opportunity she provided me to come work with her. But if it hadn't been a great opportunity, how would I have been able to say no to her?
I was thinking. You know, I should ask Mike because we talked with Annie a little bit about what it's like to, you know, run and start a business. And I should ask Mike what he's like working for Annie, but I figured he'd just give me an answer like that.
Well, Annie's an incredible resource for Epic. She's so smart, and she's the person that, you know, you don't want to argue with because she's so good. On the other hand, I'm going to do my job better because, I mean, Annie's going to pick at what I'm doing, you know, that I've run some feature that she doesn't like the way it's, I mean, she doesn't have, like, you know, she's not, like, exercising editorial authority, but if she says something like, you know, you really made this guy sound like, he wasn't that great a player, and I said, no, I was saying, you know, he's a wild card, and he plays a wild style, and she says, well, no, that sounds like it's insulting. Well, it's like, now, I've got to do my job better because I can't just write things carelessly without thinking about it because I know that she's looking at it and she's not going to give up easily on an argument. Likewise, you know, as an ambassador for the league, I saw during the World Series main event, we took out a suite and players, on days that they weren't playing would come by and sign their league paperwork or get, answers to questions about the league or do video interviews with us that we have now on the site. And I saw a number of players come in And they would say, I'm interested in hearing about it, but I'm kind of skeptical and hear what I think the problems are. And I was, involved secondarily in talking with these players. And, I was a lawyer for 15 years and a very successful one, and I'm a good communicator. And so I understood what we were doing, and people had reservations. And Joe Priam, our director of player relations, was expert at these things and is great at working with the players. And, players would say, I may play, but, here's this problem, here's this problem. When Annie came in, I would see 100% of the time, even skeptical players would be charmed by her because it's not a matter that she's a genius and she's going way over people's heads, or she's a great arguer and she's badgering people into it. She's a very charming person who understands the player's point of view. And so I saw a number of players come in who I thought would be skeptical. It seemed like they were skeptical, but after talking with Annie about it, she understood what their reservations were and knew how to deal with them. And that's really, that's what her strength is. That's the way she harnesses what she's great at as an asset to the league, because she understands the player's position and can communicate with them in a way that, the light bulb goes off and they say, oh, this is why this is so much better than, what somebody else is doing. This is why some reservation I had doesn't apply. It's just impressive to watch.
I would imagine not many people win an argument with Annie or that she backs down from. I think you're all just fantastic. You did a wonderful job. So you're also an accomplished author. You've had 4 books published. You have any more on the way?
I'm starting to work on one right now. It's at the very early stages. I mean, I feel like the Homeric epic of poker in this age went from being the Andy Beal game to being the story of Full Tilt and Black Friday. And so I feel like, if I want to bookend this age of poker, I could say I was there at the beginning, that, the 2001 through 2004 story, when poker was, just really getting its legs, I was there documenting the highest stakes players and biggest games. Well, now, so like the biggest game is, Full Tilt, this, potentially multi-billion dollar company, which was started by these brilliant gamblers and provided great service for, thousands and thousands and thousands of players, ended up having to shut down, and there are all these allegations out there. What was great about them? What did they do wrong? What was bad about them? What did they do right? All these things. And so, I'm looking into that. I mean, it's very, it's really too early. I mean, it's too early to write such a book because the situation is still fluid, but it seems to me that, if I want to make my mark on, both ends of the poker era, if I want to write another book that's going to be something that can compete with The Professor, The Banker, and The Suicide King, then I have to write the Full Tilt story.
I look forward to it. I look forward to that. Whether
I prove to be, too lazy to write it, or, too comfortable just sitting in my office and writing and editing for the website in addition to that, remains to be seen. But, sort of like the part of me that wants to take challenges says this is an incredible story, especially because, I've been friendly with a number of the principals of Full Tilt and have followed the company for so long. I've worked for Full Tilt. I've been friends with Howard Letter, with Chris Ferguson. I've, talked with Ray Vitaro about the founding of the company. And so, there are fascinating stories there. And to me, it's a lot more than just, they went out of business and they owe players money. There are stories behind that. There are issues about management of the company and things they did wrong. But there are also a lot of interesting stories about what they did right, or about, the great fortunes that were made as well as fortunes lost. And so, there's a lot out there. And I hope the story comes out, of course, because I'd like to hear the story. I feel like I might be the one who tells it.
And it always fascinated me how in the span of, time, and especially economic time, how fast it all happened, how quickly it went from nothing to a billion-dollar company.
I was working on a project with Howard Letter in 2006, and I came to his door. It was October 2006, and I knocked on the door, and Howard answered the door, and I said, "How are you doing?" He said, "Today is the worst day of my entire life." And it was the day that Congress put back on its schedule, on the last day of its 2006 session, what became the UIGEA. And he was on the phone having talked with people who were involved in lobbying and the legislative process, how Congress had been thinking about this issue, and it had apparently fallen off their radar, and it was the last day of the session. And then in some sort of backdoor 11th hour move, it got stuck to a law that was sure to pass, so that it was going to end up passing without even any discussion. And so he said, "This was the worst day of my life." And I often thought about that in the subsequent years. In a sense, it was the best day of his life. I mean, Full Tilt turned into a colossus as a result of, just to wrap up, the, he said it was the worst day of his life. And for years, it seemed like, it, in retrospect, it was the best day of his life because Full Tilt became a colossus based on, Party Poker leaving the market, and Full Tilt, and, you know, along with PokerStars, willing to take the risk of, an eventual prosecution to exploit that market and then use that to become international powerhouses. But then, it's been such a tough year for him this year, and he's been vilified, and I understand why people are really angry at him as an embodiment of Full Tilt. On the other hand, I don't think the whole story's out there, and I feel bad for him, and I think, well, maybe, that did sow the seeds of Full Tilt's destruction when they made the decision to move forward, a decision that made them huge amounts of money and satisfied, hundreds of thousands of players, but at the same time put them in a position where, the government could, haul them into court, take them out of, seize their money, put them out of business, and then, make them pariahs in their own community. And so,
our government's not afraid to do things out of spite, so.
And again, this is why, the story interests me so much. I've been friends with Howard for so long. Not like close friends, that we're on the phone every day, but, we've worked on a number of projects together and just spent a lot of time talking about things. And, I've always told him that, I'm worried for him, and I'm worried for Full Tilt. I mean, this is, since 2005, I've been saying this to him. And, and he's always explained to me, the time and effort they're putting into trying to do things legally or trying to lobby to get regulation so that they can be transparent, and, the lobbying effort and the legal effort. And I said, I just worry, Howard, that someday, some prosecutor is going to act like you just captured Saddam Hussein when he invites you. And, of course, Saddam Hussein's gone. So then I got to tell the story for a while with Osama bin Laden. But now he's gone. And so I got to tell the story with Gaddafi for a little while, and now he's gone. But now it's just Howard Lederer now.
Just Howard.
And which I think is unfair, and I hope will eventually be, revealed as unfair. But, it's tough when you get in the crosshairs of the U.S. government. Whether the government is right or wrong, it has incredible, awesome power. And when you're on the other side of them, it's not a good place to be.
And when you toss in that kind of money, that everything's just amplified. And even what leads up to the things that happen and to the fallout is amplified too. So you're right; it's going to be pretty interesting when the final story does actually come out, if it ever does. So, Mike, we want to thank you for joining us tonight. You've been a wealth of information. It's been a lot of fun having you. I want to hit the TV shows one more time this weekend on CBS. What time does that start?
The Velocity Final Table beginning is 10 o'clock Eastern time on Friday on Velocity Network. On Saturday at 1 p.m. Eastern, CBS has the conclusion of the Final Table. And that will also be on Velocity the following Friday if you end up hitting the Velocity broadcast and not catching the CBS broadcast. But Saturday at 1 p.m. Eastern is the CBS broadcast. And obviously, what I'm trying to do in telling you all these stories, so this Full Tilt stuff isn't part of what's on the website, but the point is that this is how strongly I feel about poker and poker players, and I'm trying to transmit that to people who come to epicpoker.com, that it's interesting people with interesting lives and interesting things, and the more you learn about them, the more interesting poker can be.
Yeah, and you can check all that out at epicpoker.com, and you can see all the wonderful bloggers and contributors Mike has, including himself in there. And where can we get your books, Mike?
You can get them on Amazon. If bookstores are still in business, the brick and mortar ones, they still carry them. Professor Benkert's Suicide Game has been in print continuously and will be for a long time. Even the Full Tilt Poker Strategy Guide is still in print, although I wouldn't be surprised if the publisher is not pumping those out every day with Full Tilt situation being what it is. But you can generally find that in bookstores and definitely on Amazon.com and as well as on Kindle and other ebook reading devices.
And the 50 best, worst, and best and worst business deals of all time, you think you'll ever update that one? It's been about 11 years now.
I don't know. Yeah, I used to be a securities lawyer, and so I was involved in financial markets, and I found those stories of big business deals interesting. And so I wrote that book when I decided, after I retired from practicing law, that I wanted to try to write books, and it was a great deal of fun, and it was a cool book, and it's gotten a lot of notice over the years. There have been so many big deals since then that it definitely should be updated. The problem is that back when I wrote it, I was reading the Wall Street Journal every day. I was going online every day and reading CNN's business coverage. I was reading Business Week every week. I was constantly immersed in the financial issues. I've been constantly immersed in poker now for about 7 years. I couldn't tell you that much about what's going on in big business deals unless they involve guys who play poker in their spare time.
Well, you could add maybe Full Tilt in there, and then our mortgage crisis could probably go in there as a bad deal too.
Oh, yeah, well, there's, all right. there's plenty of stuff.
Plenty of stuff. All right, Mike, we do want to thank you for joining us. You are welcome anytime, you and anyone else from Epic 2, and good luck with the broadcast and everything else. We hope to see you again soon.
Thanks very much. It's been a pleasure. Thank you for having me on.
All right. Michael Craig from Epic Poker. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll have more stuff. I told you you had good stories. Hey, well done to Dutch Boy, too. Very impressive. Dutch has a new show you might want to check out. Go follow him on Facebook. Thanks again to Michael for his return trip. Always a pleasure. I can't wait to pick your brain again. I hope he does write that book. It'll be a great story. Keeping tabs on Michael and Epic Poker League is easy. Just go to epicpoker.com. He also has a few great books you can check out on all sorts of topics, including poker. And you can get them at a bookstore nearest someone you know, or at Amazon and other fine online retailers. Don't forget to catch Epic Poker League on TV, on the Velocity Network, and weekends on CBS. You can check your local listings for times. Big thanks to Michael and, of course, the commish Anydew for letting us hang out with Epic now and then. Hope to see you guys again soon. Good luck. Thank you for downloading an Onto Radio podcast.